Romeo India Whiskey here. My name is Dick. You'll also hear Kilo 2 Kilo Echo Yankee. K2KEY. His name is Mel. Mel and Dick make an attempt to organize this slightly crazy crew, very enthusiastic people who meet most Sunday evenings to discuss their favorite subject, ham radio, and lots of stuff that's connected with it. I'm developing a theory of late which says that inside of many ham radio operators, there's really a scientist trying to get out, trying to understand how all this stuff works. Not everybody falls into that category. Some ham radio operators are very happy just to plug the rig in, plug in the microphone, connect an antenna, and start talking. Others want to know, how does that antenna work? How does that transmission line work? What's happening at the molecular level? We get all kinds of levels of questions along those lines on the technical net over the last 28 years. So we claim this is the brand new, improved technical net, which means that during the first hour we make a serious attempt to at least briefly answer everyone's questions. Don't get bogged down with the really deep material during the first hour. Near the end of the first hour, let me drop. Near the end of the first hour, we go over to the mailbag where the newer amateurs who don't yet have the ability to sign on to the TechNet live, the majority of the questions get answered on the TechNet live communication. But for the people who don't yet have the ability to get on to ham radio because they're in the process of getting their license, quite often younger people, but not always, they mail in questions, and Mel has heroically volunteered to attempt to answer at least the valid-sounding ones. There are times when Mel gets hundreds of emails per week. So go easy on him, because from my point of view, we've never really promised to give a written consulting service, if you know what I mean. I mean, we've gotten some very nice left-handed compliments where people will send us their master's or doctoral thesis for review. As I said, it's a nice compliment, but that's quite beyond what we're volunteering. A person signs into this technical net to join these crazy people by giving us your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in might sound like this, WS2N, Paul, and yes. So do we have any questions or comments from people? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
KC2, QIQ, Glenn, and yes.
Glenn recognized. And boy, we have conversations with... Are we going to have conversations for you tonight? Okay, anyone else besides Glenn? Give me your call letters and name right now.
K2GJE, Ed, with a comment on balance. Over.
Very fine. K2GJE, I think that was Ed. Very fine on balance. That's a darn good subject. Okay, we've got Glenn and Ed so far. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name.
W2TRP, no.
Okay. I haven't heard from you in a long time, Mr. TRP. Glad you're with us. And like to have some further conversations with you when we get a chance. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name.
Good evening, K2KEY.
Good evening, Mel. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name. My mind is slowly coming back. Irwin, I think, was W2TRP. Okay, Glenn, KC2QIQ. What would you like to talk about tonight? And when you see those Richard Feynman lectures that I've recently rediscovered, from my point of view, they're extremely good. He's got a very nice way of explaining things, even though that was done way back in 1982. And Richard Feynman, as you probably know, was heavily involved with the so-called Manhattan Project. He was one of the geniuses that helped develop the techniques that resulted in the atomic bomb. It's sad that he died too soon from my point of view, because he was doing some great work. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, go ahead, Glenn.
Hey, good evening, Dick, and I think what we'll do is, those are all interesting stuff. I did get a look at those, and I think we'll save that for the later hours after everything else first. But tonight what I wanted to talk about was pin switches, some of the theory and myths behind it. In the last couple of weeks, I've been doing quite a bit of measurements on pin switches for use mainly with Doppler antennas, And there's been a lot of questions that were raised about biasing, how to bias the diodes, you know, what kind of insertion loss and isolation you get from on and off from the biasing, using multiple pin switches in series to improve the performance, distributing pin switches on different ends of coax, and also running pin switches to control antennas, the effects of pin switches into antennas that are in good match as opposed to antennas that are into bad match. I'm not sure where you feel more comfortable starting first, but maybe we could start. I'll pass it back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
You're on a roll, as I see it, Glenn, so go right ahead with any of those details you'd like to discuss. And when you're through, I'll put in a bunch of comments of what I think of pins. Over to you, Glenn.
Okay, now, actually, what I found was biasing was one of the first questions that came up, and I found that when I'm measuring with a network vector analyzer, and I look at everything into good 50 ohms, biasing, it doesn't appear that I need a whole lot of current to turn these diodes on. And, my first diodes that I was experimenting with were 1 in 4148, and just basically biasing them on with a milliamp or two seemed to get very low forward insertion loss, and when it would turn off, I could easily, without any shielding or anything else, get about 20 dB of isolation in the off mode, and maybe even a little bit more than that, but say at the higher frequencies, 20 dB max. Then I started adding pin switches in series, just putting them, adding them, and I found out that, you know, basically it was additive. If I had 20 dB and I used two diodes in series, I get 40. Put three, you get 60 dB. shielding also helped. Basically putting shielding around the outside, you know, prevented stray signals from getting back into the receiver. Let me let it drop. Other things that I noticed was, or was brought to my attention, was that if you put different pin switches on opposite ends of a coaxial feed line cable, that it can improve the performance. I didn't see it. Maybe, you know, there's different tests I can do, in other words, but I found that if I use pin switches properly shielded and put in series and biased properly in one location, seemed to work just as well as if I put them on two different ends of the cable. Maybe you have some words on that one. The other thing was that I found when I was biasing pin switches into cables and antennas, that when the antenna was in a good match at its resonant frequency and being used at that resonant frequency, the switch was most effective. Into poor reactive loads, the switch responded poorly. But, Dick, that's some of the things that I've been experiencing, and maybe you can shed some light on it. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
One of the mysterious things in your last two transmissions, Glenn, is that you specifically mentioned a 1N4148. I just looked at the data sheet for 1N4148, and it says high-speed diodes, 1N4148 through 448. Apparently there's a whole series of them in there for various breakdown voltages and currents, but they're called high-speed diode. That tells it's not a pin diode. In the case of a diode being used for switching of RF circuitry, a fast-acting diode does a beautiful job if and only if the amount of forward bias is greater than the peak inverse current that you intend to pass. In other words, if I'm passing a signal that's creating a 50 milliamps of positive and negative peak current throughout its sine wave, and if I've got the diode only biased 45 milliamps forward, that means throughout 90-some-odd% of the cycle, the diode is forward biased, but a certain percentage of the cycle, it will be reverse biased, and therefore it will be making some other harmonic energy and will doing some less than ideal forward current transfer. 4148s, properly used, can do a beautiful job, but that's not a pin diode. A pin diode is one where you've intentionally created this intrinsic region between the N-doped region and the P-doped region. You've got this other region in between where the material drifts through, the holes of the electrons drift through there very slowly. A pin diode selected ideally for, let me drop. A pin diode selected for a particular operation. You intentionally choose a pin diode where the, let's call it the switching speed. I think it's called minority carrier lifetime or something like this, but you want the switching speed of the diode to be very, very slow compared to the RF energy that you intend to pin diode switch. If I was trying to pin diode switch at 1 gigahertz, where each cycle is 1 nanosecond long, and if I've got a pin diode that has a carrier lifetime of not 1 nanosecond, but 10 nanoseconds, that would be an ideal environment. In other words, even though I'm only biasing it forward with 10 milliamps, and even though the peak current I'm putting through it is 50 milliamps, because the diode is so slow, it doesn't see that particular inverse voltage, inverse current, because it only occurs briefly, and it's only looking at the average that's charging into that intrinsic region, if you know what I mean. So, pin diodes, that's one kind of diode, certain kind of operation. On-off ratio, in other words, when it's forward bias, a really good one will have something like 1 ohm of on resistance, and when the reverse bias, they'll have megohms of off resistance. So they've got a lot of switching capability. And when you start cascading them, quite often they will cascade them through quarter wavelength of cable between them to increase some of the switching characteristics. Or is it eighth wavelength? But there's an ideal wavelength between them. One other thing I should mention to you, let me drop
this. This K2KEY, I gotta say something, Dick.
Yeah, we're getting too deep already, is that what you're saying? Mel, go ahead.
Oh, I'll tell you what, I'm getting a lot of emails. Okay, we're talking about pin diodes now. What is a pin diode? Why don't you explain? Here's what I'm gonna say now. A pin diode, for those who are listening, because I'm getting all kinds of things that they have no idea what we're talking about half the times with them. Things that we bring up, we have to go to the, what are they basically. So let me put this way, a pin diode is that Dick and Glenn are talking about right now. There are three general methods for switching. You can have a switch on a front panel, you can have a relay, or you can have diodes. And that's what we're talking about. The thing that does the same as a switch on a front panel or a relay, but doing this now on the electronic basis. Over.
Yeah, it sounds like you've got a little bit of a cold, Mel. You're absolutely right. We should walk into it slowly. PIN stands for positive intrinsic negative. So it's a special kind of diode used for electronic switching. If you study the schematic diagram of many of the transceivers that we own, you'll discover that right at the, very near the output connector, is a set of chunks of electronics that do the transmit-receive switching. When you're in the receive mode, you want the antenna connected to the receiver. When you want the transmit mode, you want the transmitter connected to that same antenna. So that single-pole, double-throw switching function can be done with an electromechanical relay. That's the way Mel and I did it in the old days. And after that, people started doing electronic switching. Pin diodes and ordinary fast-acting diodes, properly used, can do that electronic switching. And I'm discovering now that the majority of the miniature circuits that are used in things like cell phones and RFID readers and whatever, when they need electronic switching these days, the most popular technique is a field effect transistor acting as the on-off switch, a pair of them, would give you a single pole, double throw switching function. So we're talking about electronic switches and how they're used. So, and what you're discovering also, Glenn, is that the command signal you give to that electronic switch, depending on its rise time and fall time and any ringing action and whatever, if you don't carefully tailor the waveform that's doing the commanding of the electronic switch, it also can create extraneous signals into a doppelscan type receiver. We've gotten probably off to one side, but maybe this helps a little bit, Glenn. KC2, QIQ, good subject. K2L.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
K2L, IW for a second. You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, very good, Dick. You know, I did this experiment with mainly the 1N4148 diode because it's one of the diodes that's used in the Ramsey doppelscanner. And, you know, it's one of the things that I started taking measurements. And there was a lot of questions that, you know, people had come up with. And some of the things that were being said were didn't quite ring true to some of the measurements that I was making. And one of the things was, you know, if you try to make one of these doppelscanners very, very wide band, you know, so that you could have a broad bandwidth of frequencies to operate this on, you know, by putting the diodes at opposite ends of the cable is going to improve it. Now, I agree with you, certainly. It could be optimized with a cable length for a specific frequency and a specific tuned antenna, but would that improve the bandwidth of the overall by putting it at the end of the cable? I didn't see that. The other thing I didn't see was that when I was doing these tests, by putting, pin diodes at opposite ends of the cable, I was getting any more isolation or better, insertion loss or overall performance from the switch. But the other thing I did notice was that when the antennas are bad matches, in other words, if you try to use one size antenna for multiple bands, that for wide bandwidth, that doesn't really work so well with the pin switch. It seems like that pin switching action really wants to look at good match no loads on both ends. But when the impedance of an antenna is off, like say if you try to use a 2-meter antenna on 440, the overall performance is pretty stinky. Maybe you could say a few more words about that one, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, the electronic switches that we're talking about, whether they be fast-acting RF diodes, miniature type, or pin diodes, or FET switches, either of those three electronic switches, and even the electromechanical relay, all of them have a certain amount of contact resistance when they're in the on mode. A good electronic switch might go down to a half an ohm or one ohm of on resistance. When it's in the non-conducting or off mode, an electromechanical relay would be many megohms, just a little bit of straight capacitance. Each of these electronic devices will have some number of measurable ohms, probably tens of megohms in the off mode, and again with some straight capacitance. Once you understand that in the off mode, the device is going to have some number of picofarads of straight capacitance, and if you don't like the on-off ratio you're getting, let me drop. Common sense would lead you to believe that you just put two of them in series. And if I was getting 30 decibels of on-off isolation out of the first electronic switch, putting two of them in series, common sense would say, hey, I'm getting 30 dB of loss from the first one, 30 dB of loss from the second one, I should be getting 60 decibels of on-off ratio when I cascade two of them. Doesn't work that way. Because if you look at what's really happening, when you're in the off mode, the straight capacitance of the device is still coupling a small amount of signal through. That's where the 30 decibel of on-off ratio is coming from. If there was no contact resistance and no straight capacitance in the off mode, no signal would flow through, and you'd be getting an infinite number of dB of on-off ratio. So some number of picofarads left in the device in the off mode is coupling signal. When you put a second electronic switch in series with the first one and co-locate them, and let's assume that the first one gave you an off capacitance of 2 picofarad, and now I've got two series devices of 2 picofarad each. By the laws of series capacitance, you've got 1 picofarad total of the two in series. That means whatever amount of reactance you got there doubled. That really means that adding the second device, in the worst case, where you think you're going to get 30 decibels more on-off ratio, you may only get 6. You've got twice the amount of reactance, half the voltage coupled through, half voltage is 6 dB down. So if you had 30 dB with one single electronic switch and you co-locate two of them in the identical mode, the possibility exists you're only going to get 36 dB instead of 30. When you start putting the right kind of an electronic circuit between the first device and the second device, whether it's an LRC circuit, whether it's a filter, whether it's just the right length of cable, there's various ways of getting most of the 30 dB per
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
There's ways of getting most of the 30 dB per switch and therefore 60 dB total. And this is all based on the assumption that the switch is acting like an open circuit into an antenna that is a 50 ohm load at that particular frequency. Well, some of our antennas, we know that they become highly reactive. If I was feeding the end of a dipole instead of the center of the dipole, where the input impedance is 1,500 ohms, and if I've decided to do my electronic switching at that location, because the 1,500 ohms of reactance at one particular ham radio frequency, my picofarad, and my electronic switch is 1 picofarad, as you can see, because the impedance I'm feeding is very high, because the reactance I get from my switching diode in the off mode is also a high capacitor reactance, I could still get a tremendous amount of signal flowing through. So depending on the exact spot on the Smith chart, in other words, your exact impedance dot, so to speak, for your particular antenna on this particular frequency, you'll get different amounts of performance of the electronic switch in both the forward mode and the reverse mode. Let me drop. Like maybe your particular electronic switching device in the on mode has 1 ohm of remaining resistance. And because your particular antenna doesn't have a 50 ohm load, which would be ideal, but it's got a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio, where it represents a 10 ohm resistor as a load, and the on resistance of your electronic switching device is 1 ohm, you can see now that only 90% of the voltage flows through, and that's something like half a dB or so of extra loss. So when the impedance of the antenna is very low, your electronic switch gives you loss in the on mode that you don't like. When the impedance of the antenna is extremely high at this frequency, then you don't get as much isolation in the off mode as you'd like. So electronic switching is not quite as simple as it looks. The schematic diagram, you just see a simple diode on the page, an RF choke feeding bias to it, and an input and output coupling capacitor, and it looks like a very simple circuit. But it is really, although it looks passive, it is quasi-active, and you have to figure out what the rest of the network is doing to really figure out what performance you're getting if you're unhappy with that performance. Maybe that helps a little bit, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the tech man.
Yes, it does, Dick. And, you know, this is mostly, I think, what I've been measuring, and, you know, I'm just glad to hear you're reinforcing it. What I'm also noticing, too, is that with the cable lengths, now, if I were to put, you know, two diodes at the end of a cable, you know, one end of cable and put the other one at the other end, like you're saying, there's a certain point or frequency that the cable's going to be at a length and the antenna's going to be resonant where that's going to be effective. But to think that you, just by putting the diodes at different ends of the cable with a fixed antenna, that that's going to be broadband, I think is a bit of a stretch. So I've been reading some Doppler articles that have been saying that you know, by putting the diode on either end of the cable with a fixed kind of a whip, you can cover a very, very broad band of operation. And I don't think that that's really true. I think to really get this kind of a Doppler scanning system to work properly, you really have to change the whips and, you know, keep an eye on, and you're going to be limited, I think, to the amount of on-off impedance that the switch is going to give you. And it is, you know, like I think when you get to that 25 dB area, I think, you know, you probably hit kind of near a sweet spot, which is probably not too difficult to achieve, but probably is good enough to, I think, make it work, if you know what I'm saying, Dick. The other thing, too, is shielding. One of the problems I noticed with the Ramsey design was that I seemed to get a lot of bleed over. In other words, the switch wasn't effective until I started putting shielding around the outside. Once I shielded the switch and put it inside a nice metal enclosure with nice RF connectors and used nice shielding all the way around, I seemed to get much better performance out of the switch as opposed to, this is at 2 meter and 440, by the way, than if it was just in an open circuit board in free air. Maybe you could say something about that as well. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
K2KEY would come in.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, I have to inject every so often because, I'm a little bit stuffed up here. I worked in I was in a lab this week with a, they believed that any temperature under 80 degrees was freezing, so with a denizen of viruses, and I picked up a little bit of it. No, but a PIN diode, actually, in its design, was really a slow switching type of diode of a device. It is not as rapid as we envision in other diodes in electronics. It was designed originally, all PIN diodes actually were very much involved in higher frequencies. Microwaves actually was its original, intent for that diode. But of course it's gotten into everything from there on. But it is a slower response type of device. In fact, I believe, I may be wrong, but I think it acts more like a resistor than a diode at the higher frequencies, Dick, over.
You're absolutely right, Mel. When you look at the data sheet for PIN diodes, you will see a graph where the vertical axis is number of ohms it acts as, and the horizontal axis is the number of milliamps of forward bias current. So as you put more and more current into the diode, the curve comes down in sort of a parabolic shape, and it gets very close to the bottom for a very low number of ohms. And when you put very little current through it or back bias it, the curve curves up to the left-hand side and up, representing very high number of ohms. And the magic of a pin, and Glenn's not using a pin, the 4148 is an ordinary fast switching diode, which can do electronic switching, but you've got to be a little bit more careful. You have to make sure that the peak current that the diode sees from an RF point of view, let me drop, that never exceeds the bias current. In the case of a fast switching diode, if I knew that the peak current of RF I'm putting through the diode when the diode's in the on mode is going to be 50 milliamps, I would like to have considerably more than 50 milliamps of forward bias current into the diode for my commanding circuitry to make sure that at no time is the diode approaching a very low number of milliamps of forward current. Otherwise, it's going to start rectifying a portion of your RF waveform. It'll start flat-topping that waveform, and that is a method of generating harmonics and intermodulation distortion and extra insertion loss. The magic of a pin is that because of this PIN structure, it's intentionally made as a very slow diode, as Mel was telling you. The magic of the pin is that I could be switching an amount of RF energy that is half an ampere through the pin on the peak of the RF cycle, and the half an ampere both forward on the positive half of the cycle and negative half an ampere on the negative half of the cycle, and I might be biasing the pin with only 100 milliamps. And at first you would say, gee, isn't that going to start going into the conducting mode during the time when the peak negative current is greater than the forward DC bias current that's trying to turn it on? And the answer is no, because even during that short portion of a cycle, you're getting 400 milliamps of current in the wrong direction, trying to unbias the diode, so to speak, because its response might take a microsecond, and your signal is only going to be there for a tenth of a microsecond. It never gets a chance, because the diode is intentionally chosen as a slow one, it never gets a chance to go into the non-conducting mode. So the magic of a pin is I can be conducting RF current considerably greater than my bias current. An ordinary fast-acting diode is the other way around. You've got to make sure your bias current is considerably greater than the You've got to make sure that your bias current is considerably greater than the peak of the negative RF current. Now, when the diode goes into the non-conducting mode, there's always some stray capacitance there. The stray capacitance is going to be coupling signal. Also, there's radiation coupling the signal. The magic of radio, the thing that we like so much about it, is you put a signal into an antenna here, and some number of miles away, that signal gets propagated into the air, another person hears the signal. We like radiation. But when it comes to circuitries that are doing electronic switching, that radiation is going to hurt you. In other words, normally we radiate a signal from our antennas over miles, and what's going to stop that signal from radiating over our circuitry for 1 inch? It's going to radiate very well over that 1 inch. So when you've got a circuit that you think you're turning it off, but some of the input circuitry is exposed antenna-wise to the output circuitry 1 inch away, if the two are not shielded from each other, if there isn't a barrier, so to speak, with the diode going through a little mouse hole in the barrier, if you don't have something like that, the signal will couple radiation-wise between input and output, even though you think you've electronically turned off that circuit. Let me drop. There's another point I'm going to make here. So where you're looking for the state-of-the-art in on-off ratio, you have to make believe that the circuitry is a beautiful antenna on the input end, even though your switching device has now become non-conductive. You've got to make sure that the RF energy being radiated as a local E field or a local H field from the input end doesn't get a chance to see the output end, so shielding is required. Now, when it comes to cascading devices because you want higher on-off ratio, one of the ways of doing it is to recognize the fact that when one of the devices is turned off, if that device is on the far end of a quarter wavelength of cable at that frequency, That quarter wavelength of cable has essentially an open circuit at the far end where the electronic switch is located. A quarter wavelength of cable will always give you an impedance inversion. Therefore, the input end is going to look like close to a short circuit. A very low number of ohms, like 5 ohms or 3 ohms. And if you've got another pin diode a quarter wavelength away, you can see that now when it's in the off mode, presenting an impedance of thousands of ohms of just straight capacitance, you'll get more on-off switching action for that particular setup. Now, can you do that at multiple frequencies? It's an interesting question. An odd number of quarter wavelengths of cable, as long as you've got a 3-to-1 frequency range, so to speak, you could be using quarter wavelengths of cable in between switching devices if you absolutely have to have a higher on-off ratio. There's another technique. Let me drop. And because in many cases putting quarter wavelengths of cable between multiple switching devices is mechanically not convenient, another approach is to use the pin diode switches as duals in both shunt and series. In other words, one switching device is in series with the center conductor of the cable, and when you want to turn the signal off, you make that one an open circuit. At the same time, the shunting device, another pin diode, so to speak, you turn on. So you really have a series and a shunt pin diode, and you operate them in opposite polarities as far as the commanding signal is concerned. Turn one on, turn the other off when you want to conduct the signal, and then reverse the process. So without using quarter wavelengths of cable, you can now get much more on-off ratio without putting quarter wavelengths of cable. As I see it, Glenn, in order to make this circuit really work well, let me drop. The ideal approach would be to choose antenna types which at each of the frequencies of operation represent a pretty good impedance. If, for instance, you wanted to make a doppelscanner that works on both 2 meters and 450 with the exact same setup, there are ways of putting loading coils into those whips so that they give a good impedance on both 450 and 2 meters. And also, you've got to be a little bit careful in the way you choose the number of antennas that are being switched and the number of feet between them, so that you still have reasonable fractions of a wavelength to get the doppelscanning action. You may have to, if you really want to operate on 2 or 3 separate frequency bands to really do it right, you might have to go from 4 to 6 antennas, so to speak, and carefully chosen spacing between them. So antennas that have the right impedance at each of the frequencies, diodes that are used in pairs, both shunt and series, and good shielding. By the time you put that all together with the right waveform for doing the commanding, so that the waveform itself is not making spurious signals, there's a whole art and science to doing electronic switching of the kind you're doing, and it looks like you're in quite a learning curve there. And by the time you finish all this, I think you shouldn't keep that light under a bushel basket, Glenn. I think you should write an article, at least in the AIL, in the, here we go, in the Limark record, if not in QST Technical Topics, KC2, QIQ. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Dick, and thank you very, very much here tonight. There's some of these items that, you know, I'm glad we're bringing to light, because I think there's just so many myths out there about the operation of how this stuff is working. And some of the measurements that I've made and just the, you know, the comments that you're making back are exactly what I'm seeing and kind of what I expected, but I just wanted to make sure, because I want to address a lot of these items in an article, but I just want to make sure I've got everything on the right page. The only other thing is that I realized that this whole thing started with the Ramsey kit, and I used 1N40, 1N48s. I'm just wondering, is there a pin diode suggestion that you could have? Because I would like to build the circuit that has the shunt, and it would use a dual polarity biasing scheme where on is forward biased and off is shunt biased. So that circuitry I kind of already have a good handle on, but I was wondering if there is a pin diode that you would suggest and the kind of biasing current you would think for. This is really just all reception, so we're not talking about big currents here. So maybe you could suggest a diode and what kind of biasing current you would possibly suggest for that as well. Because, you know, here again, I've in the reception, I haven't really, on this doppelscanner with the 1N40, 1N48, so I haven't really found that I needed more than, say, a milliamp or two to really get these that diode to perform okay. But I might be missing some better performance with a better pin diode that you might be able to suggest. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
I got a good one.
Yeah, I believe, Mel recognized, I believe your Doppler scanner is used in such a way it's always used in the receive mode, in which case a couple of milliamps of forward current on a 4148 is more than enough. I think you never transmit through that particular antenna assembly. Is that true, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yes, absolutely, Dick. There's no transmission through this system. Things would just get damaged. And, yeah, it's really just a receiver on one end, and basically we're just switching the antennas with an oscillator roughly at about 500 hertz. So, you know, we're really interested in, you know, receiving performance and just, like you're saying, not creating a lot of outside noise in the biasing. But I really do feel that that forward diode and shunting scheme is really going to be the best diode performance I can get, and probably only needed in one location for wideband performance. And as it is right now, I am using a dual-banded whip, and it seems to work well for both those bands without having to change them so far. So, certainly a suggestion of diode and the biasing current that you would suggest. I think you're saying that probably 2 mils would be good no matter what diode. But let me pass it back to you and Mel. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I've got a whole lot of comments as to why Ramsey chose the 4148. You might have very little choice without spending a lot of bucks, but maybe Mel already knows of one. I did a search about 5 years ago for pin diodes that operated below a couple hundred megacycles. Pin diodes have a high frequency performance area, and you go down to lower and lower frequencies, they're no longer a pin, they're an ordinary diode, which is not necessarily bad, but because the number of pins available for low frequency operation is now becoming quite rare, I'm a little afraid they could be pricey and there could be some other disadvantages. Let's see what Mel has to say on this one. K2KEY, where's your favorite pin diode, Mel? K2RIW in the TechNet.
You know, I'm always looking for things, and I needed pin diodes for a unique project. You remember a few deeper. And I put in several filters into the receiver, and I wanted to have a way of switching these filters in and out. So I started looking around for pin diodes. I didn't want to go with relays. In other words, I didn't want to use a relay. I'd have to use, you know, a relay for each of the filters. That meant putting in six relays. And so I decided I'm going to look into pin diodes. And a friend of mine suggested at the time, he said, you know, we got a Motorola, one of the companies, so he says we get a Motorola rep comes down all the time. Let me see what he's got. And he did. He had an MPN, Mary Peter Nancy, MPN 3404, and they worked like a charm, Dick. I've used them for switching the filters, and the pipe was very right, of course, but they worked terrific, to say the least. Look into them, MPN 3404, Glenn, over.
Okay, and when you find that data sheet, they will tell you what is the minority carrier lifetime, which tells you what frequency below which you've got to be careful about what bias you put onto it, because it might start becoming a rectifier. And the 4140, I'm going to guess that the pin diodes that go low enough in frequency these days are becoming a bit rare. The ones that are there, I'm a little bit afraid they're going to be expensive, and therefore 4148s are what Ramsey chose. On top of that, 4148s are literally a dime a dozen almost. They're very inexpensive. Properly used, I think they can do the job very nicely. They've got an extremely small amount of off capacitance. They've got moderately good on resistance. I'm going to guess a 4148 in the on mode is going to be something like 5 ohms. On a 50 ohm antenna, that's not bad. It's only a couple of tenths of a dB insertion loss. All electronic switching, no matter how you do it, always creates some insertion loss. So sounds to me like you're getting some pretty nice reaction out of that that your Doppler scanner. And I think probably, if I know you by now, you've already driven it around the neighborhood quite a bit. You know where the emitter is. You've done some circles in the parking lot. You've watched the indicator. And I'll bet you most of the time it's within 15 degrees of where the emitter really is compared to your car. Is that approximately true, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And to Leo.
Rich recognized, but Glenn first. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yes, that's exactly it, Dick. And I've had such great performance But I think there's a lot of questions, you know, that people are having about it and, you know, and how it works. And I've been trying to address some of these questions slowly, but I would like to put them all together and, as I said, expel, you know, some of the myths about it and some of the things that I've really discovered here. And actually, some of the 1 in 4148s that I've been using so far have been the surface mount version, the little surface mount pill diodes, the little glass ones. Without leads, and you just basically solder the end caps together. And in the location where, on the little center board that Ramsey made, where they were using one, they were basically surface mounting a leaded device, 1 in 4148, I've basically taken two 1 in 4148s, put them in series, and just kind of like soldered them together right on the existing pads. And very, very good performance so far. But I would be interested, and I'm glad to hear that Mel said the 3404, because I think there's a series of 3404 through 3406 that is readily available. You know, they're maybe a dollar or so a piece. And I believe the only thing I wasn't sure was whether I can get them in surface mount or not. But if I can get them in surface mount, it's certainly worth a try just to solder them in there and really see if there's any direct benefit from it. But thank you very much, Mel. And I'm going to pass it back to you, Dick, and maybe you can pick up Rich. K2RIW, KC2QIQ. Thanks again.
Electronic switching is something we all need from time to time. On connecting an antenna to a transmitter and a receiver, there you'd like to have a single-pole, double-throw switch function. When Mel was putting in multiple bandpass filter assemblies into his receiver, and he wants to switch in the narrow filter, the medium filter, and the broad filter, and he was doing it with electronic switching. It is my opinion, Mel, he stood a chance of doing it with relatively small electromechanical relays that were not designed for RF circuitry. If the relay is small enough and your frequency is low enough, like an IF frequency, 455 KC, 9 megacycles or whatever, these little crystal can relays sometimes can do an extremely good job. Even though they're not 50 ohms in to out, there's ways you can adjust for that so that the insertion loss or the impedance that they create can be canceled at the operating frequency. And then when they're in the off mode, there's a little bit of stray capacitance, and with the right inductor across those pins to resonate that capacitance, it becomes an open circuit. So I've seen a number of people use miniature electromechanical relays in a RF purpose, even though they were not intended for RF, and with a little bit of smarts and the way you lay it out and shield it, and put extra circuitry around it, you can get extremely good performance. And is that the best way to go as opposed to an electronic? There are pros and cons. And I think you said Mike Papa November 3404 for that pin diode. Now let's see what Rich's got to say about all this. I bet you've done some repairs of pin diode circuitry and all the repairs you've done on electronic ham radio equipment, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, K2RIW, TechNet, Weimar, Ken, 2EO. Well, you know, you may remember, I don't know if you saw my article, Dick, I think, what was it, April 1981 issue of Ham Radio Magazine. I had redesigned the receiver section of a Heathkit SB-104A, and some of the work I did was in collaboration with W4, I don't remember his call, we were very successful using, and this was on 80 through 10 meters, to switch the input bandpass filters of the SB-104. They went right into an SBL-1 mixer, and I used Motorola MPN-3401s. I subbed them for the original 1N4148s, which is what Glenn wants to do, and it worked out extremely well. Back to net, MPN-3401.
And I wonder if anyone within the sound of my voice has seen any of these devices on the surplus market, any other market. Mike Papa November 3404, 3401 type pin diodes. Do they still exist? Has anyone done a search for those? In the next hour or so, somebody will do a search and we'll find that one out. Anyone with a quick answer on that one right now? K2RIW listening. We'll eventually find out. In your particular purpose, though, Glenn, I'm not convinced where you've got a very simple receiver function where as you switch between your four whip antennas on your beautiful metal plate on the top of your ski rack of your car, Now, if I think on each one of those antennas, if you have something in the vicinity of a 25 decibel on-to-off ratio, I think you're going to get 97%, so to speak, of all the Doppler performance you can get. And yes, if this was the best of all worlds, you'd like to have 60 decibels of on-to-off ratio. But that may be well beyond the law of diminishing returns, if you know what I mean. A slight difference in performance with a higher on-off ratio may not be required. Because the way the Doppler scan works, the dominant antenna is one that's giving you the particular phase angle of reception at this particular quadrant of the receiving time. And then when you turn off that antenna and go to the next antenna, there is a characteristic phase shift of the RF signal that goes into the receiver. And that's it's what the Doppler scanners, scanning of the four antennas is really doing. Let me drop. It's really making an instantaneous jump in the particular phase angle of the RF reception going into the receiver. But you're doing that at a 500 cycle rate. Each one of those individual antennas is on for one quarter of the time of 500 cycles. That's equivalent of 2 megs. That's a half a microsecond. Each individual antenna is on for roughly half a microsecond. So if I give you a particular phase angle for half a microsecond, and then another phase angle from the next antenna for another half microsecond, the ordinary bandpass characteristics of the IF strip of your receiver smooths that all out, and it becomes essentially a particular characteristic sine wave, and that sine wave is the 500 hertz sine wave, which overall settles down to have a particular phase angle compared to the commanding phase angle of the 500 cycle signal that's going to the diode switching network. The comparison of those two phase shifts of the commanding 500 hertz versus the resultant 500 hertz of FM modulation that's really done by the phase shifting technique coming out of your discriminator, it is that comparison of those two signals with a particular overall phase shift that gets displayed on the front panel as a particular angle of arrival. As long as you're not making glitches that create an instantaneous quieting of the receiver, so to speak. I mean, most receivers, if you give them a sudden blast of a spurious signal, they go into a certain amount of dead time. And that's one of the modes by which a Doppler scanner made by Ramsey could go into a desensitization if you had the wrong kind of circuitry doing the commanding, which is making too fast a rise time, too bad glitches, improper shielding, and so on. Anybody with any further questions or comments?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Anybody with any further questions or comments on electronic diode switching networks and Doppler scanners in particular, give me your call letters and name right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ, just with a follow-up, Dick.
Okay, Glenn, recognized. Anyone else? You've got it, Glenn.
Yeah, very good, Dick. I just want to thank you again, you and Mel both, and for your input, and Rich as well. Here again, it's just one of those things where, you know, there's so many questions involved in this, and just one point about the, you know, a lot of the things that have been blamed with the Ramsey system was this, you know, spiking noise and interference that's being caused back to the receiver, causing a tremendous amount of errors. And just the mere fact of shielding and grounding of that whole system seemed to take care of most of that noise that was causing all the problems to the receivers. So there's a lot to be said for shielding and grounding, as opposed to open circuit boards sitting up on the roof with long cable lengths in between. But I think that's enough said, and I'll pass it back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, shielding is very important. One of the things that Andy of A2CDL has discovered recently is that his commanding circuitry for his diodes, where his antenna is, his Doppler switching antenna is up on a tower remote from the shack, so to speak, and his particular circuit was feeding those with twisted pair. Now, you talk to various people as to how well twisted pair is shielded, whether or not it's really isolated from the outside world or whether it's acting like an antenna and picking up a signal. And the answer is both yes and no. If you're using twisted pair in the truly differential mode, dual differential mode, that means during the commanding cycle, one wire gets plus 1 volt and the other wire gets exactly minus 1 volt. On the transmitting end, with controlled impedance of those two signal generators, the dual differential signal generators. So that combined with proper loading on the far end, where everything is kept symmetrical, the exact same amount of capacitance of each wire to ground, so to speak, the exact same amount of resistive and reactive loading on each wire to ground, you truly use differential sending and differential, fully dual differential receiving on twisted pair. Under that circumstance, twisted pair will act to you like it's got a double or a triple shield of coax braiding on the outside of it, so to speak, even though it's nice, simple wiring. So twisted pair, under the right circumstances, is extremely well shielded. Under the wrong circumstances, it is an antenna picking up signals and can give you all kinds of grief. You'd be amazed how many people don't really understand all the rules and regulations, so to speak, to get full performance out of twisted pair. Let me drop. Very similar to what was going on with 300 ohm twin lead used by ham radio operators back in the 70s. Back in the 70s, 300 ohm and 200 ohm twin lead was the lowest loss UHF transmission line we could buy. Properly used with the right kind of standoff insulators, we had the right kind of a balancing device on the transmitting and receiving end, it worked like a charm. If you didn't obey all the rules, if you took your twin lead and put thumbtacks through it when it ran across the floor, so to speak, and it came across the metal ductwork and some of the routing in the house, and you didn't bring it through the wall correctly, and you made sharp bends, and you didn't use the right kind of standoff insulators, and you just simply taped it to the tower, there's a zillion ways you can misuse twin lead. If you don't obey all the rules, you get very poor performance out of it. The nice thing about coaxial cables, it's a lot more forgiving. The bad news in those days, the coax cables that were available to us had a lot more insertion loss. Okay, we'll be going back to the subject quite a bit. Sounds like you're writing a very nice article there, Glenn. Lots of people are going to appreciate that because there's a lot of art and science to doing electronic switching that's only partially known. Okay, Ed was the next person, K2GJE, K2RIW. Go right ahead, Ed.
K2RIW and the TechNet, this is K2GJE. I think last week Mel had a question from somebody that wanted to match some 450 ohm open wire line to a 50 ohm antenna, and I knew I had some data on making some very inexpensive balans. You probably can use a balun at each end or an antenna tuner at the transmitter end and the balun at the antenna end, and I have some data on making one that I got from a ham years ago. Unfortunately, he's a silent key, and I can give it to you tonight if you want it. Over.
We sure do want that, Ed. It sure would be nice if there was a particular article in Ham Radio or QST, and you could tell us the month and year. If it was a homebrew, that's going to be a little bit more difficult to convey all the information, but whatever you got, go right ahead. 450 ohm to 50 ohm conversion, balance. How did you do it, Ed, and how would you do it today? K2GJE, K2RIW.
Okay. No, this is homebrew data, but it seems fairly good. He uses an F240 MIX 61. I think F240, he says, from Palomar. And he winds 15 turns of number 18 stranded Teflon. Why, I don't know. I like to use personally enamel covered wire and insulate the core with some tape, but that's what he used. That was the 15 turns went to the 450 ohm line, and he winds 5 turns around the core for the 50 ohm load. He puts the whole thing in a large PVC pipe cap, and he pots it with silicone glue and brings out two screws for the 450 ohm line and a UHF connector for the 50 ohm connection. It seems relatively easy to make. The data doesn't sound bad. I don't know why he uses the number 18 gauge Teflon strand, and maybe that's just what he had. I personally probably would use enamel covered magnet wire. But the data doesn't look bad, and it seems like very easy to make. Over.
I'll make a comment on that.
Very fine. I'm going to guess that he used a stranded 18-gauge wire, which is a poor man's equivalent of Litz wire, L-I-T-Z. Way back in the dark ages, they discovered that when RF energy is flowing through turns of wire on a transformer or a coil of any kind, when you have multiple individual turns, you get, because of the skin effect, you get a lot better RF performance. I think the difference is small. Also, when it comes back to you, I'm going to be asking you questions about sizes. Mel, go ahead with your comment. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, most of the people that were making the cores of themselves sound at that time were using what they call thermalized wire. And the explanation, as Jerry Civic put it, you know, he did a lot of work on it. I recall one of his designs, is because if you use regular enameled wire, what happens is as it comes across the edge of the core, it has a tendency to bite through. In other words, you're making sharp turns and it'll bite. It cracks the enamel and bites through vibration or whatever. It just eventually will not work well. So he used to use what they call thermalized wire, which was just a stranded coated wire. And he found that he never had any kind of breakdown, Dick. Over.
That's good to know, Mel. Now, this Palomar core F240 Mix 61, which you're going to wind on these 15 turns for the 450 ohm connection and 5 turns for the 50 ohm connection, and you stuff that into a PVC pipe. I wonder what diameter PVC pipe cap. I'm also a little concerned. How many watts do you believe this is good for, Ed, if you happen to know? Do you think that this size, and the fact that you're stuffing it into a PVC pipe cap, means to me that it's not a huge device, and I'm a little worried about whether or not this would tolerate 1,000 watts, if you happen to know. K2GJE, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And KC2QIQ with a comment.
Okay, Ed first. Go ahead, Ed.
K2RIW, K2GJE. He does mention this is good for 200 watts, and he does also mention a T-400 core for 1 kW. That's the only data I have. He doesn't give me the size of the PVC cap that he used, and he just said to use silicon RTV. To pop the whole thing up. And I imagine you probably can even come up with better potting compounds. Over.
Silicone is a very good potting compound. If you've actually seen one of these with your own eyes, Ed, the F240 core by Palomar, make a rough guess. How many inches in diameter do you believe that core was? Back to you, Ed.
I don't remember. I think it was roughly maybe a 2-inch outside diameter core. Over.
Okay, that's a good guess. So then a pipe cap that is 2.5 inches of inside diameter would probably do it very well. I know that you've made quite a few of these ferrite core type balance in your day, Glenn, so go right ahead with your comment. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Well, it's an interesting, you know, conversation and topic, but just something that I've done in the past, and I haven't heard too many people mention this, but it's something I've tried, and it's worked very, very well for me, at least anyway. I wish other people would try it and give me some feedback on it, but what I've done is I've taken 400 ohm, you know, 450 ohm, standard ladder line feed line, and fed a dipole, but instead of cutting it for, you know, quarter wavelength on each side and half wave, I cut it a little bit longer, closer to 5/8 wave, and the impedance is going to be a bit higher than 50 ohms. And what I find is that when I use a 4-to-1 balun on the shack end and then bring it back into a coaxial cable and into a small antenna tuner or directly into the rig, I get a very, very wide bandwidth. You know, like if I try it at 20 meters and instead of cutting it for a quarter wave on each side, cut it for 5 wavelength, 5/8 of a wave on each side, and it's a dramatic improvement in the antenna. I was just wondering if you're familiar with this, Dick, or ever heard of it before.